Good morning. We welcome you to the 24th annual Ryan Lectureship. It was in 1964 that Dr. and Mrs. Lowell Ryan saw the need for an annual series such as this, in which we would be able to bring to the campus outstanding Christian scholars from various disciplines in theological education. If you look at the persons whom we've had the privilege of having as our Ryan lecturers in the last 4 or 5 years, you will note such names as C.K. Barrett, Lawrence LeCour, William Williman, Dorothy Gish. And this is representative of the outstanding Christian scholars whom we've had as our distinguished lecturers for this series. So today, the Ryan lecture is a permanently endowed lecture series here at the seminary. And I think this is a tribute, once again, to a warm-hearted pastor who had the vision that Asbury would also be an intellectual center for front-edge thinking in theological thought. We are so thankful to Dr. Ryan and to his late wife, June, for making this lecture series possible. Dr. Ryan is with us here today and will lead us in our opening prayer. Dr. Ryan.
Shall we bow our heads in prayer? To begin with this morning, our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the gift of a new day. A lot of people didn't make it through the night, but you have brought us into another day, bestowed upon us the gift of life again. We pray that through this day we shall be obedient to your will for our lives, and that we shall live faithfully in your guidance. We thank thee for this institution, Asbury Theological Seminary. We thank you for all of those who came before us, established this great school, made it possible for us to be here today. We thank you for our administration here at the seminary, our Board of Trustees, our faculty, our student body, our staff, our alumni across the world, and the multitude of friends and supporters that pray for us daily and support us by their financial gifts. We thank you this morning for this lectureship and for the speaker of the day. We pray that as he teaches us in speaking to us, that each of us shall be a learner, and that as we leave this place, our lives shall be strengthened for further service in the kingdom of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you, Dr. Ryan. To introduce our speaker of the morning, I present to you the newly installed Frank Paul Morris Professor of Systematic Theology, Dr. Lawrence Wood.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. We're pleased this year to have as our Ryan Lecturer Dr. Stanley Hiawass, Professor of Theological Ethics and Director of Graduate Studies at the Divinity School, Duke University. Dr. Hiawass received his B.D. in 1965 from Yale Divinity School and did further graduate studies at Yale University, where he received his Ph.D. in 1968. In the judgment of many people, Dr. Hiawass is the leading ethicist in the nation today. One of the distinctive features of his writings has been to restore the meaning of the word Christian to ethical thinking. Many of you are already acquainted with several of his books and have come to appreciate the theological substance and the personal tone of Dr. Hiawass's writings. His publications are quite numerous, much too long to list in an introduction like this, but several titles will certainly stand out to many of you students who have been in some of our classes, mine as well as others, like John Kilner, who have taught you ethics, such as Vision and Virtue, A Community of Character, The Peaceable Kingdom, Against the Nations, and suffering presence. Now, don't get me wrong on what I'm about to say, but Dr. Hiawas has a Bob Hope quality about him. He can be serious, blunt, and humorous all at the same time. Now, I'm not saying he's a comedian, except when he wants to be. And we might get a little flavor of that here and there as he speaks to us. I'm not sure. But he conveys a feeling that he really enjoys the truth. And truth for him, as he has taught us, is not simply discussing moral problems involving human relationships, just simply discussing moral problems, nor is it a lot of principles and ideas which can be frozen into a system. One of the things that he has taught us is that ethics is theological in its core, and theology is rooted in the story and real history which God has with his people. I first met Dr. Hiawas in Chicago at the Society of Christian Ethics. Upon learning that I taught at Asbury Theological Seminary, he clasped my hand rather firmly, and with a look of pure excitement on his face, said something like this: "Us crazy sanctification people gotta stick together." I gathered that he meant that Wesley had something pretty important to contribute to Christian ethics. While many people looked upon perhaps Wesley's views as being eccentric and irrelevant in the contemporary world. Later during the conference, Dr. Hiawas exercised a bit of his good-natured humor when one of the speakers was listing some of the reformers and their significance for Christian ethics. Dr. Hiawas halfway stood up, lifted his hands, and spoke up to the surprise of the speaker and said, "And don't forget John Wesley." The speaker stopped. He looked a bit startled and surprised, and then said, "Oh yes, we don't want to forget John Wesley." Dr. Hiawas has done much in the way of presenting some of the things that we hold very dear to our own hearts here in the way of a Wesleyan commitment to ethical thinking. And he has represented that well in his books and in his public lectures and in his life. And we're glad that he is with us today. Let me share one more story that happened in another conference. I was sitting in a discussion group, where Dr. Hiawas' book, The Peaceable Kingdom, was being discussed. And he was present as he listened to his peers critique and review his book. And then he was given an opportunity to interact and interchange with different people. And this was a rather, from a theological perspective, a rather mixed audience, representing a number of different views. And one of the ideals of ethics, I suppose, of teaching anyway in university is being pretty open-minded. Dr. Hiawas said, "I intend consciously and unapologetically to change people's lives in my teaching." Dr. Hiawas, we believe that your presence with us today will reflect that intention, and I trust that it will be successful, that our lives will be changed because you have been here with us.
We always say it's awfully good to be here. I don't know if that's true or not. It's wonderful to be here when Larry has received this honor. And it's wonderful to be at a place which still requires its people to take an oath to be part of the faculty. Alastair MacIntyre ends "Whose Justice, Which Rationality?" with the point that the modern university became unintelligible when, as a matter of fact, that there were no longer any oaths required of the faculty, because then what happened was is that people thought that they could, they thought that that would mean that people would believe alternative sets of convictions, but in fact the modern academy today is characterized by the fact that people don't believe anything. And therefore rationality is impossible within those contexts. It's wonderful to be at a place that would still require its faculty to take an oath. I just hope you feel enough the oddness of the modern world to understand what you just witnessed. I'm simply not happy with happiness. I do not trust being happy, and I tend not to trust happy people. For how can anyone who is happy know what this world is like? We live in a world of suffering and tragedy that defies our attempts to be happy. I especially distrust people who try to be happy, as happiness, whatever it is, does not seem to be something we can accomplish. The kind of self-involvement that trying to be happy entails is simply incompatible with the disinterested character of genuinely good people. I particularly distrust the notion of happiness when it's associated with religion. For example, when Christianity is commended as a religion of happiness, it always seems to lose any critical bite. It becomes a religion promising a satisfaction for the well-off, such that the radical demands of the gospel are overlooked or explained away. As a religion of happiness, Christianity becomes a general form of religiosity that is so functional, useful, the question of whether it's true hardly makes any difference, especially among the bourgeois. Moreover, if Christianity is about happiness, then what are we to make of the repeated and insistent claims that suffering is the hallmark of the Christian life? Because of this general unhappiness with happiness, I've tended to avoid the language of happiness when thinking and writing about matters moral. This seems a bit odd, however, as no one has influenced me more than Aristotle, and the Nicomachean Ethics begins and ends with discussions of happiness. Moreover, accounts of the moral life that stress the importance of virtue usually involve a teleological account of our moral existence that entails some sense of self-fulfillment. In my attempt to avoid happiness as a theme, therefore, I've somewhat arbitrarily used only the middle books of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics and developed an ethic of virtue that only promises faithfulness, which may accidentally provide a sense of fulfillment. Yet I suspect that there's something deeply wrong with any attempt to give an account of the moral life that avoids happiness or at least makes it a secondary phenomenon. It may be that happiness is wrongly thought to be the end of the moral life, but it's quite another matter to think it has no relevance to living well. Moreover, no account of Christian ethics can avoid dealing with happiness, not only because it is such a prominent human concern, but because the very nature of the Christian life entails a sense of well-being that is surely not entirely unlike what some have meant by happiness. Indeed, I call your attention to John Wesley's and Ernest's appeal to men of reason and religion, where he suggested that one of the most important questions you can ask anyone is, are you happy? Assuming that the question of the rationality of religion was not separable from the questions of what makes you happy. Wesley says, you eat and drink and sleep and dress and dance and sit down to play. You are carried abroad. You are at the masquerade, the theater, the opera house, the park, the levee, the drawing room. What do you do there? Why, sometimes you talk, sometimes you look at one another, and what are you to do tomorrow, the next day, the next week, the next year? You are to eat, drink, and sleep, and dance, and dress, and play again. Are you, can you, or any reasonable man be satisfied with this? You are not. It's not possible you should be. But what else can you do? You would have something better to employ your time, but you know where to find it upon earth, but you know not where to find it upon earth. And indeed, it is obvious that the earth, as it is now constituted, even with the help of all the European arts, does not afford sufficient employment to take up half the waking hours of its inhabitants. What then can you do? How can you employ the time that lies so heavy upon your hands? This very thing which you seek, declare we unto you. The thing we want is the religion we preach, That alone leaves no time upon our hands. It fills up the blank spaces of our lives. Thus, we should be happy. It's very interesting, of course, however, that Samuel Johnson said, Wesley seemed like an interesting man, but he never would sit still long enough for a good conversation. Which, for whatever we can say about our alleged founder, we know he was not a man of sense of humor. Because he had no sense of leisure at all. My sense of ambiguity about happiness, however, is captured by two scenes from the movie Tender Mercies, a movie that was filmed not far from where I was raised. You know, it's filmed around Waxahachie, Texas. In the first scene, Max Sledge, this drunken country western singer who's been reformed, after being told his daughter has died in an automobile accident, is seen hoeing the weeds in his garden. His new wife, who has helped him recover a sense of dignity, stands silently at the edge of the garden. Mac, without looking at her, it's wonderful how the silences work in this movie. Mac, without looking at her, says several times, I don't believe in happiness, but he keeps on hoeing. She makes no attempt to persuade him otherwise, yet the movie closes with Mac throwing a football with his young stepson as if nothing else mattered. Like Mac, I do not believe in happiness, but I do believe in throwing footballs with stepsons. The problem is knowing how to describe the latter as a way of life. Now, what I'm going to try, therefore, is to develop an account of happiness that hopefully will do justice to our moral experience as well as suggest the role happiness might play in the life of those who desire to be Christians. As a way to explore the nature and role of happiness in the moral life, I'm going to undertake an analysis of Aristotle's account of happiness. Now, don't let that scare you. If you hadn't read the Ethics, I hope I'll say enough that you can follow it whether you've read it or not. But I'm going to bring Aristotle and us in conversation. That I do so is not surprising, as it's a common assumption that Aristotle's account in many ways is still unsurpassed. I must tell you, however, that while I hope the analysis I develop is true to Aristotle, correctly interpreting Aristotle is not my primary interest. Rather, I'm primarily concerned to use Aristotle to further how we ought to think about happiness. In the process, however, I hope to suggest why Aristotle's account is still so important, not only for what he says, but for how his analysis is structured. So I'm going to take you a pretty detailed way through how he argues. Of particular interest to me is Aristotle's claim that happiness requires completeness in virtue as well as a complete lifetime. Happiness requires completeness and virtue as well as a complete lifetime. Much of what I'll be attempting is to try to understand what such an observation could possibly mean. It's not only unclear what or how we could ever have completeness and virtue, but even more puzzling is the claim that it takes a complete lifetime. For example, one of the implications of such a claim would seem to be that feeling happy is no guarantee that we are happy. Indeed, if you feel happy right now, you are probably under the grip of a massive self-deception. That's the implications of Aristotle's views at this point. Put even, for according to Aristotle, it seems that happiness comes not during, but at the end of our life, thus the fear among the Greeks of untimely death. It's very interesting in this regard that one of the decisive differences that we will want to look at is for Aristotle, nothing could be more tragic than for a person to die before they've had a chance to live a complete lifetime, before they've had a chance to develop all the virtues. Remember, what we Christians assume, Aristotle and we both agree that philosophy is fundamentally a training in knowing how to die well. For Christians, the presumption is it's all right to die early. Before we've developed. And of course, that throws all of this in a somewhat different light from this, but it's one of the crucial things. But for Aristotle, it was unthinkable that you could die early. Happiness is the characteristics of those who live in a manner that the end of their life confirms the way they have lived. The happy person, thus, is one who can claim their death as their own. Objections to such an account of happiness seems obvious, since it seems we can be sure we are truly happy only when it's too late to enjoy we are such, namely, we're dead. cross-thought Aristotle's mind, sure. Yet I want to try to show that Aristotle's account of happiness, of complete virtue in a complete lifetime, is more plausible than it at first appears. For I think Aristotle is rightly struggling to take account of the contingent and temporal character of our existence. That may not seem very significant, as we often fail to acknowledge, either in our moral theory or personally, how time can appear to be the great enemy of morality. For example, just think on how a personal level, what appears to be so clearly right later appears as pathetic, if not positively corrupt. So often, both existentially and in theory, morality seems to be an attempt to defeat the necessity of such retrospective judgments in the hope of securing moral consistency, a consistency that seems crucial if we are to achieve happiness. Recognition of the timefulness necessarily means we must deal with the question of moral change and continuity. We usually think we ought to do some changing in our lives, but it's by no means clear how that conviction is compatible with our sense that a person of character has a stability that ensures we can trust them to be who they are. See, I really am talking about sanctification and how you give an account of continuity of self in sanctification. As we shall see, Aristotle's analysis of how of the kind of person we must be to be capable of true happiness manifests rather than resolves this ambiguity. Exactly because his account of happiness does so, however, I hope to show it is a particularly rich resource for helping us understand what it might mean for Christians to be happy. Now, where do you begin an account of the moral life? It has been the tendency of modern ethicists since the Enlightenment to begin their reflections on morality from as formal and as minimal a starting point as possible. The tendency within evangelical ethicists to always want to start with principles that are grounded in absolute truth is not Christian tradition, it's Enlightenment, that drinks deeper at the well of Kant than it does at the well of the New Testament. That people begin ethics that way is because they hope to find a foundation for ethics that is non-arbitrary and rationally compelling. That is, one that is not temporally determined. Aristotle, however, begins in a quite different way. Aristotle simply asks what most people think living life well involves. That is, what is their highest good? He suggests many claim morality is about being happy, and he's willing to begin with that assumption. I mean, the way I think you ought to think the way Aristotle works is like an Amway party. He starts and says, what do you want? I want a Winnebago. Well, all right, I'll start with that. I mean, if you think selling soap's going to get you that and it's going to make you happy, that's what we'll begin with. And see, as a matter of fact, through reflection, if that's going to sustain you for a life. I mean, Winnebago's rust. Yet Aristotle, in Socratic fashion, does not assume he knows what happiness entails, for that's exactly the issue that needs investigation. Therefore, Aristotle accepts the common assumption that the highest good has to do with happiness, only in the hope of tempting us to follow him in an investigation of that claim. We must be careful, therefore, not to assume any one statement adequately summarizes Aristotle's views about happiness, as he constantly nuances his first formulation through the entire argument of the ethics. For example, Aristotle begins by observing that though all agree that happiness is the highest good, when they try to define happiness, there's little agreement. The more common, no one in this room, say that happiness is some pleasure and or wealth, or some identify happiness with different things at different times. Thus, when we're sick, we want health. When we're poor, we want wealth, and so on. And some, the more cultivated us, who have thought about these matters, think happiness cannot consist in a list of goods, but must be a good in and of itself, which is the cause of all these goods. Obviously, the initial agreement on happiness as the highest good attainable requires further analysis in order to be plausible. Yet it's important to note that Aristotle does not assume that such analysis can be successful by ignoring what people actually want or desire. Happiness is not the result, as some later Stoic thinkers would claim, of the eradication of desire. It's not a a Schultz beetle that Snoopy looks at and says, that's the secret, reduce your worries to a minimum. That's not what Aristotle wants. He wants you to desire. We will not be happy, according to Aristotle, if we purge our lives of all desires, but only when we desire the right things rightly. But even the most cultivated desires, such as that for honor, cannot bring happiness, and honor depends upon the opinions of others. Therefore, to be happy, Aristotle suggests, we must desire that which cannot be easily taken away from us. As we shall see, this is a particularly important aspect of Aristotle's account of happiness. For though he says it can only be a guess at this point, he continues to assume that happiness must be that which we cannot lose either through the actions of others or by outrageous fate. Thus he maintains that the happy person, quote, will have the attribute of permanence and will remain happy throughout his or her life. For he will always want the highest degree both to do and contemplate what is a conformity with the virtues. He will bear vicissitudes of fortune most nobly and with perfect decorum, all under all circumstance, inasmuch he is truly good and foursquare beyond reproach. Even more strongly, Aristotle suggests that, quote, no supremely happy man can ever become miserable, for he will never do what is hateful and base. For in our opinion, the man who is truly good and wise will bear with dignity whatever fortune may bring, and will always act as nobly as circumstance permits. Just as a good general makes the most strategic use of the troops at his disposal, and a good shoemaker makes the best shoe he can from the leather available, and so on with experts in all fields. So you see, what Aristotle is about is what kind of account of the moral life do you have to give that will be able to sustain the kind of constancy that will allow me to say that I'm happy even under outrageous fortune. Even under outrageous fortune. However, in Book 7, Aristotle says, Aristotle was not a person that was ever short of sense. In Book 7, Aristotle says, those who assert that a man is happy even on the rack and even when great misfortunes befall him, provided he is good, or talking nonsense whether they know it or not. Since happiness also needs fortune, some people regard good fortune as identical with happiness, but that's not true. For even good fortune, if excessive, can be an obstruction. Perhaps we are in that case no longer justified in calling it good fortune, for its definition is determined by its relation to happiness. See, Aristotle is fascinated with this problem, as Martha Nussbaum calls it, the fragility of goodness, which is a book that everyone needs to read, Martha Nussbaum, The Fragility of Goodness. And because what he's concerned about is how do you give an account of the moral life that enables us to own our life as ours happily in a way that it is not subject to good luck. Because, I mean, and what I mean by good luck is good luck can destroy you just as much as bad luck can. You all know the kid that got born to a rich family and it absolutely destroyed them. I mean, good luck is, I mean, or inheriting a lot of money can destroy you. Having friends that are too supportive can destroy you because you don't notice you don't have character. Aristotle is concerned with the fact, you see. I mean, what he's deeply concerned with is what kind of account of the kind of moral formation do we need to give of each of us to be able to sustain the possibility of surviving good luck, of morally surviving. I mean, it's very hard in America. If you've been born in America, you've been born with good luck, and therefore you've got a good chance of being corrupted. We're in deep moral trouble, and Aristotle is deeply concerned with that. We thus have an increasingly complex picture. Aristotle accepts the general assumption that happiness is the satisfaction of desire, but the question of the kind of desire we should have to be happy is not easily determined. In this sense, I mean, the question of modernity has always been, why should I be moral? Aristotle doesn't start there. He doesn't even think it's an interesting question because he doesn't think it's an interesting question that you can separate morality from etiquette. That's a deep mistake from Aristotle's point of view. That's what Kant teaches you. For Aristotle, if you ask, why should I be moral, his response is, what do you like to eat? I mean, look, if you desire something, you're in the game. So he wants to start with us fleshy beings in that one. He suggests that it must be a desire for which is not easily lost, that is, that which will not be subject to the fortunes of time, yet it's unclear what could possibly satisfy such a demand. In order to investigate this issue, we must return to Aristotle's claim that happiness is, quote, a final end. As we have seen, Aristotle begins his account of happiness assuming that happiness has to do with an end, that is, the highest good attainable by action. This assumption reflects his general view that, quote, all knowledge and every choice is directed towards some good. Every human activity has some good, such as it's one thing in medicine, another in strategy, and another again in the arts. What then is the good of each? Is not that for some sake of which everything else is done? That means it is health in the case of medicine, victory in the case of strategy, a house in the case of building, a different thing in the case of the different arts, and in all actions and choices it is the end. For it is for the sake of the end that all else is done. Thus, if there's some one end for all that we do, this would be the good attainable by actions. If there are several ends, there will be goods, they will be goods attainable by action. It is important to note the conditional in the last sentence, for Aristotle at this point does not assume that there is any one end for all that we do. For he notes that it's obvious that there are many ends, wealth, health, power, that are means to something else. Thus, it is by no means obvious that all ends are final. But if there is one good, it must be something that is final. But what would it mean for such an end to be final? It is an end, Aristotle suggests, that can be pursued for itself and not for something else. It is not a means to anything. And such a description seems to apply to happiness above all else, to quote Aristotle, for we always choose happiness as an end in itself and never for the sake of something else. Honor, pleasure, intelligence, and all the virtues we choose partly for themselves, for we would choose each of them even if no further advantage would accrue from them. But we also choose them partly for the sake of happiness because we assume that it is through them we will be happy. On the other hand, no one chooses happiness for the sake of honor, pleasure, and the like, nor as a means to anything at all. Such a claim, however, is anything but obvious. Is Aristotle suggesting that happiness is dominant in the sense that everything we do is ultimately done for it? If so, such a view seems to presuppose a view of human action that's clearly mistaken. I may jog to lose weight, and I may desire to lose weight to better my health, and I may desire to better my health in order to live longer, and I may desire to live longer because, well, I'm not sure why I desire to live longer. The reason I'm not sure is why I desire to live longer is not simply because I lack a clear aim in my life that requires more time, or because I so fear death, but because desiring to live longer is a complex set of desires that involves everything from wanting to see the Chicago Cubs win a World Series. Who says I'm not apocalyptic? Are to enjoying the friendships that I've just begun to develop. To describe the final end in such a singular manner, namely that for which everything is done, seems to fail to do justice to the complex nature of our desires. Moreover, there seems to simply be something wrong about Aristotle's assumption that one action is always a means to something else. I may jog, even as boring as jogging is, for my health, but it's by no means clear that my jogging can best be described as a means at all. You know, I've been jogging now for 15 years. I'm a compulsive about it. And I've learned that when people ask me, now, why do you do it? I say, it's complex. While I'm glad that jogging can result in better health, the fact that I jog cannot be so easily explained. Before we get too taken, however, with such criticisms of Aristotle, I think we need to reconsider what Aristotle is trying to say. Certainly, Aristotle is not suggesting that simply because every action has an end, even if that end is itself, that therefore all actions have a common end. Nor is he suggesting, though it's easy to be mizzled here by his examples, that there is some peculiar act to whose all others are subordinate. Rather, we must be particularly careful to note why Aristotle calls happiness a final good, for he does not mean happiness is one end among others. The point is that happiness, rather than being analogous to other goods we desire, is different in the sense that it is sufficient in itself. And by self-sufficient, he means that which, taken by itself, makes life something desirable and deficient in nothing. By sufficient, he means that which, taken by itself, makes life something desirable and deficient in nothing. For ironically, the above criticism that suggests there are some things that are worth doing in themselves is exactly the idea that Aristotle needs to display how happiness is a final end. Eudaimonia, the word that Aristotle actually uses for happiness and is not easily translated into our word happiness. Eudaimonia, what all people want is not the result or outcome of a lifetime's effort. It is not something to look forward to like contented retirement. It is a life enjoyable and worthwhile all through. Various bits of it must themselves be enjoyable and worthwhile, not just a means for bringing about subsequent bits. But the primary ingredient of eudaimonia, or for the sake of eudaimonia, is not incompatible with their being ends in themselves, for eudaimonia is constituted by activities that are ends in themselves. Only if eudaimonia has such a character could it be a good that cannot be easily taken away from us. Indeed, that is why it might be possible to be happy even on the rack, even though by being such we will not be makarios, supremely happy. What you see is that what Aristotle is getting at is like oftentimes people think that we need to be courageous for this or that. For Aristotle, you cannot be courageous for this or that. You must be courageous because, not because, I mean, oftentimes in a world of cowards, which we live, courage is necessarily going to result in bad results for you. Because the world of the courageous is a different world than the coward. Because courage makes the world more dangerous for us. And therefore we suffer because we are courageous. Aristotle doesn't think we are courageous because it's going to give you good results. He thinks, namely, you cannot afford not to be courageous in a world of cowards. Because otherwise then you wouldn't have the kind of life that was capable of being happy. If this is the case, then we can see why many commentators on Aristotle resist translating eudaimonia as happiness. For happiness is not an end that can be pursued or achieved separate from the kind of life we lead. Our life is not a means to some end called happiness. Rather, eudaimonia is the name Aristotle gives to the best possible life, which means it's impossible to abstract the meaning of happiness from the display of such a life, thus the virtues. So I really can't tell you everything that Aristotle means about eudaimonia until I talk with you this afternoon about the virtues, which happiness, life of virtue, and friendship is the interconnectedness that I hope to show is necessary for any display of the moral life. However, we can now understand why that is the case, that happiness is not so much an end, but a way of life. But if happiness is not one end among others, how is it to be specified? How are we to understand the material content of happiness so construed? That is, if happiness names not so much an end that we pursue like some ideal, but names the way that we must live in order to name our lives happy. In order to turn to that, we need to look at Aristotle's understanding of the ergon, or function, of man. Ever candid, Aristotle observes that it's perhaps a little trite to call eudaimonia the highest good, and a clearer account is still required. He suggests that perhaps this can best be done by asking what is the proper function of man. As he says, for just as goodness and performance of a flute player, a sculptor, or any kind of expert, and generally of anyone who fulfills some function or performs some action, are thought to reside in his proper function, so the goodness and performance of man would seem to reside in his proper function. Now, Aristotle's appeal to function at this point in his argument has often been criticized as an unnecessary bit of metaphysics or viciously circular, since it can only result in telling us that certain excellences are essential for happiness. Moreover, some have taken him to mean that the good of man that correlates with his function is a single thing in a manner that excludes all other goods. The latter criticism is clearly wrong, however, as Aristotle, as I've tried to suggest, assumes that there are many different goods for man. And again, I think it is crucial that we not be mizzled by Aristotle's appeal to a function. by remembering that he only proposes that as a way to explore further the nature of happiness as a characteristic of all our activities. To discover man's proper function, Aristotle notes that just as the eye, the hand, or the foot has its proper function, so man must have some function over and above the functions of the various parts. That function cannot be just living, as he has that in common with the plants, nor is man's function that of perception, as he has that in common with every animal. That leaves, quote, an active life of the rational element. The rational element has two parts. One, it obeys the rule of reason. The other, it possesses and conceives rational rule. Since the expression life of a rational element also can be used in these two senses, we must make it clear that we mean a life determined by the activity as opposed to the mere possession of the rational element. For the activity it sees, it seems, has a greater claim to the function of man, the proper function of man, than consists in activity of the soul in conformity with the rational principle, at least not without it. Many have found fault with Aristotle's concentration on reason as the distinguishing mark of man. I mean, that this is too rationalistic account has especially been oftentimes criticized from evangelical perspectives. It is often pointed out there are countless things that we do besides reasoning. Moreover, if there's any distinctiveness to human activity qua human activity, it does not reside in any one mark like rationality, but rather resides in the complex ways we have learned to coordinate the capacities and skills we share with all of life. While Aristotle's use of the language of function leaves him open to such criticisms, it is clear, I think, that he does not mean to deny the many things men do are inconsequential to understanding human activity. Rather, his point is the more simple, namely that rationality is simply not one activity among others that we do, but is the activity that pervades all that we do. Indeed, it is exactly that power that allows us to coordinate the many capacities and skills we possess. Moreover, once having made the suggestion that the distinctively human is exhibited in our rational activity, Aristotle proceeds immediately to muddy those cloudy waters, for he says that by proper function, he means the same kind of function of an individual who sets high standards for himself. Thus, the proper function of a harpist is one who has set high standards for himself. Therefore, rational activity is not some minimum possessed by all. It is not a Kantian rationality qua rationality, though all men have potential to possess it, but rather it is a high standard that is the mark of distinction. Thus, in a summary passage, Aristotle says, on these assumptions, if we take the proper function of man to be a certain kind of life, and if this kind of life is an activity of the soul and consists of in actions performed in conjunction with the rational element, and if a man of high standards is he who performs these actions well and properly, and if a function is well performed when it is performed in accordance with the excellence appropriate to it, we reach the conclusion that the good of man is an activity of the soul in conformity with the best and most complete life. But we must add in a complete life, for one swallow does not make a spring, nor does one sunny day similarly. One day or a short time does not make a man blessed or happy. So rationality as the function of man is but the means Aristotle uses to note the whole set of virtues that we need to live well life over a complete span of life. Even though Aristotle distinguishes theoretical and practical reason and later suggests contemplation is the form of life that most nearly approaches happiness, he in fact assumes that practical reason is as much the source of happiness as the theoretical. Aristotle's emphasis on contemplation, and they're certainly there in Book 10 of the Ethics, as the highest ideal, certainly gives good grounds for some that would criticize him for an overly intellectual account of human activity. Yet such criticism fails to note that the life of contemplation is impossible if we're not living well a virtuous life that entails the whole gamut of the virtues. Secondly, Aristotle never loses his good sense, for even though he is attracted to contemplation, he is so because of its promise of self-sufficiency. Yet he maintains even the contemplative man will need external well-being since we're only human. In other words, we can't be happy if we're just sitting around thinking thought on thought. As he says, our nature is not self-sufficient for engaging in study, our body must be healthy, and we must have food and generally be cared for. The significance of these last considerations have often been overlooked by those that criticize Aristotle's account of happiness as too intellectualistic. For as I've tried to suggest, happiness for Aristotle is not some single activity to whose end that needs all other human activities should be subordinated. He's not saying that there's one end, the same one of all particular actions, virtuous activity of living humanly well do not signify one thing because there are different kinds of virtues, and our happiness or perfection or ultimate end is constituted not by one virtue, but to the degree that they all must work together. Therefore, happiness, it turns out, is the name of a set of virtuous activities, for Aristotle says eudaimonia is some kind of activity of the soul in conformity with virtues. But then why does he emphasize so much the rationality is the one function of man and associates that with contemplation? Partly it's because he thinks theoretical knowledge is superior, but it's also because I think that he wants to believe that theoretical knowledge will, if we embody it completely, will stop us from being subject to outrageous fortune. For contemplation, that is, thinking on things that cannot be other than they are, seems to promise the kind of permanence that can make us impervious to outrageous fate. Yet he never assumed that contemplation was sufficient to ensure a eudaimonistic life, since finally what makes such life possible, even one of contemplation, is having character sufficient to bear the vicissitudes of fortune nobly. As I've noted, Aristotle was keenly aware that frequent reverses can crush the supremely happy. It's interesting, therefore, for Aristotle, we can only, if we are persons of virtue, is it possible for us to be happy through time. We cannot have happiness unless we've acquired the virtues necessary to be people of character, and to have character means we have a history that allows us to make our lives our own. In contrast, bad people cannot be happy, according to Aristotle, because they do not have the elements of constancy and thus do not remain similar even to themselves. Goodness, as determined through the virtues, provides the skills necessary for us to be steady through the good and bad fortunes of our lives. That is why I suspect Aristotle cannot quite make up his mind whether happiness is a gift or is it acquired. For as he says, if there is anything at all which comes to me as a gift from the gods, it is reasonable to suppose that happiness above all else is God-given. And if all things human, it is the most likely to be God-given, inasmuch as it's the best. But although this subject is perhaps more appropriate to a different field of study, theology, it is clear that happiness is one of the most divine things, even if it is not God-sent, but attained through virtue and some kind of learning or training. In the same passage, he wants to say it's a gift of the gods, and yet he says he wants to acquire it because he doesn't want it to be subject. See, what he's fascinated by is he knows some people just don't ever seem to get put in a context where they're well brought up to even start the life of virtue. And therefore, they can't ever be happy in his sense of the word. And he wants to know how he can defeat that. If he can, you see. If it can be acquired rather than simply as a gift of the gods. Perhaps now we're in a position to understand better why Aristotle insists that happiness requires completeness in virtue as well as a complete life. For in spite of his talk of happiness as the final end, we see happiness is not some ideal which is realizable only in the distant future. Indeed, happiness is not so much an end, but a way. Happiness is the sense of the self that comes from having acquired the virtues necessary to transverse the dangers and opportunities of our existence, dangers and opportunities that are intrinsic to the timeful character of our existence. Thus, happiness is not something that can be accomplished all at once. Rather, it seems to be more like the ability to look back over our life and be glad that it's ours. Happiness names the ability to look back over our life and be glad that it's ours. In short, unless we've acquired a history, we have nothing about which to be happy. In this sense, you sense what a difference Aristotle's perspective on the moral life is from that of modernity. We always think of our moral life prospectively, namely, I'm going to get clear on the right principles, I'm going to think clearly, and then I'm going to make the right decision. Aristotle tends to think that the most important aspect of moral life is retrospective judgments. How am I able to look back on my life and claim it as my own happily? I can only do so if I have been virtuous, capable of claiming my life as my own. Now, obviously, an understanding of Aristotle's account of happiness requires a discussion of virtues and friendship, and that's what I'm going to do next. However, on the basis of the analysis of happiness, I think some tentative theological observations can be made. As I suggested at the beginning, I think Aristotle can help us understand in what way it makes sense for Christians not only to be happy, but to desire to be happy. I want now to say why that is the case. Some may feel that all this is a false problem. Of course Christians can and should be happy. After all, they're just like everyone else. If being a Christian does not contribute to our happiness, what good is it? Yet many in the Christian tradition have challenged that assumption. They have done so because the fundamental conviction that the gospel is meant to challenge is not destroy our presumptions about what will make us happy in this life. Christianity does not promise fulfillment, but rather a way to live in a world truthfully and without illusion. It is, after all, a little hard to believe that a people who take as their central belief a crucified God can believe that life finally is really about happiness. From such a perspective, Christian convictions are more clearly true because they underwrite our assumptions about what constitutes human fulfillment. But because Christianity challenges our facile presumptions that God is primarily concerned with our happiness. Therefore, many Christian writers have suggested that suffering rather than happiness is the hallmark of the Christian life. The Christian is certainly not encouraged to seek out bad fortune. At least for some, a bit of bad luck is seen as a positive aid for learning to live as Christians. For such, suffering tests the genuineness of Christian convictions that they live out not for their own glory but for that of God. There is no doubt that there's something right about this emphasis. In a culture like our own that seems bent on the satisfaction of every desire, no matter how shallow, such a challenge, moreover, appears positively salutary. In a time when many desire for happiness results in a desperate devaluing of all questions of significance, any challenge to the superficiality of our desires seems more likely right than wrong. Yet there also seems something wrong with any account of the Christian life that denies all moral significance to happiness. For the salvation wrought in Jesus of Nazareth, we believe, offers a new way of life that certainly brings with it a sense of satisfaction. The issue is how that satisfaction is to be understood. And in this respect, I think Aristotle is a critical resource. For Aristotle reminds us that happiness is not so much a goal as a way, or perhaps more accurately, happiness but names the kind of person we must be if we are to face the nature of this existence with courage and faithfulness. In this sense, Aristotle helps us understand why we rightly understand the kind of life we are called to live as Christians as a journey rather than as an answer. For what we're offered as Christians is not a formula for successful living, but a way to go on such that we will be able to look back over our lives with a sense of satisfaction, that is, happily. Let me try to put it this way. One of the difficulties of taking up any significant way of life is that we never adequately understand what we're doing. Significant commitments are asked of us that we are not in a position to appreciate when we first undertake them. For example, we never know what we're doing when we get married. I teach a marriage course every once in a while.